Thank you. Then I just want to make sure that you all can hear me. And Mr. Kuhn, you indicated you could before. And Ms.
That's correct.
Mollican, we can hear all of you. And so I'm going to have the marshal call the case, and then we'll talk a little bit about the procedure.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding, calling the case of the SIRS appeal by One Best Care, court file number A200904.
And counsel, I know that you both are familiar with our procedures, but this proceeding is being recorded. So if you would please state your name and who you represent at the beginning of your arguments. You each will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Kuhn, if you choose to use it. And with that, are you ready to proceed, Mr. Kuhn?
I am, Your Honor.
You may then.
May it please the court, I am before you today on a writ of appeal from an administrative decision with two main issues for the court's consideration. One is a determination that appellants, One Best Care Incorporated, is responsible for an overpayment of approximately $608,000. And the second issue is the suspension of the second appellant, which is One Network Care.
Why don't we start there? Because Ms. Bumlican argued that since you didn't raise that issue below, you forfeited it. How do you respond to that?
My response to that is in my argument, my written closing argument, as well as request for considerations, I always asked to the administrative judge in the Department of Human Services to not terminate or suspend either appellant based on that there was, I disagreed with the finding of abuse. I opted at the appellate level to, since the DHS modified the termination to just a suspension of One Best Care, I'm not putting forth that argument. I'm only making that argument as to the one party, but I never conceded that One Network Care should automatically be suspended if the other party was. So I disagree that I ever waived that. And you certainly can't make an argument that a lower court's decision was arbitrary and capricious and not supported by the record until it happens. So that would be my response to that, that I haven't waived that argument. And then as far as the argument itself, it's pretty straightforward. All of the lower administrative findings are specifically addressed to One Best Care. All the investigation all entailed billing practices and record keeping, record disclosure of One Best Care. There was no investigation and no findings directly related to One Network Care. They basically just got added in to the mix because the two separate business entities share an office space, have the same owner, the same qualified professional. So there certainly was, factually speaking, overlap between the two entities. My argument is
Counsel, isn't it more than that? Isn't it indicative that the entities were treated the same for all intents and purposes? Same business practices, same record keeping practices, same problems.
But that's just it, Your Honor, that there was no investigation of the second entity. I think it's it has to be just assumed that the second entity suffered the same problems because it had the same owner and same staff. And my argument is just we can't assume that because there isn't any facts to that effect.
Yeah, Mr. Coons, though, I thought I read in the record or in the briefing that some of the records that your client did turn over were for the other company that you're arguing against here. And those records showed the same deficiencies as the Best Care record showed. So it seems as though your client disclosed some of the records for one network that showed similar issues.
Your Honor, off the top of my head, I recall at least on one like time card that my client had wrote the wrong business entity on the time card, and he was kind of dinged for that. There weren't any specific findings that any of One Network Care's time cards or health records were deficient, and to the extent that my client might have incidentally provided documents for the other entity, I don't think that there's any findings in the record still that supports the legal conclusion that they both should be suspended. I think as far as the argument that the state makes that from a legal standpoint, they should just be treated as the same entity. Again, I just don't think the factual record was developed at the administrative level support that conclusion.
Can I ask you a question about the transcript or lack thereof? You didn't order a transcript. And when I was reading through your briefing, it seemed to me that you really weren't disputing the underlying facts.
That's a fair assessment, Your Honor. I think obviously there was some factual issues in which the transcript might have been helpful, but ultimately, my arguments on appeal are one of statutory interpretation and legal conclusions. And being that all of the exhibits are in the record, I really didn't feel that the transcript of it in and of itself was necessary for the court to have the adequate information to render a decision. I'm not entirely sure what happened with the transcript issue, but it's neither here nor there now. As far as the other argument regarding the $608,000 overpayment determination, which is just applied to the one appellate, One Best Care Incorporated. The crux of the issue is of statutory interpretation. The administrative decision is based on a factual determination that One Best Care committed abuse. And that is a statutory requirement that there be a finding of abuse, amongst other things, in order to justify sanctions. The statute itself, 156B064, doesn't define abuse, and that is where the Department of Human Services has promulgated specific rules that lay out what abuse is, which is the crux of the issue. They say the specific rules in question say it is abuse for an entity that is a PCA provider to not maintain records that comply with a specific rule within the Department of Human Services rules that apply. The department's and what is argued by the Attorney General is that I'm reading the rule too narrowly that it should mean that a separate provision in the statute, which describes what certain PCA providers are supposed to include in their care plans, if you don't do that, that should count as abuse, even though that is not what the rule says.
But Mr. Kuhn, the rule does provide that abuse can constitute a pattern of practices that is inconsistent with a sound business or a health service practice. That's the definition of abuse. And if a PCA care plan by statute is required to have certain elements in it, and the PCA care plan that was maintained by the petitioners in this case did not contain that information, then why is that as a matter of law or clear, why was it an error for the commissioner to conclude that that was abuse? It was not consistent with a sound business or health service practice.
And as a follow-up to Judge Frisch's question, it sounds like you're asking us to say it's okay to disregard the statutory requirements about what's required in a care plan.
Well, thank you, Your Honor, for your question. Two things. One, I'm certainly not advocating that a PCA provider not comply with all statutory regulations. First thing that point is the issue that the statute that sets out what is required in a PCA care plan is specific to a specific what's called the general PCA plans. There's also what are called PCA choice plans, which puts the requirement of developing and maintaining the care plan on the recipient or their responsible party. So it shifts it away from the PCA care provider, which is appellants in the situation, to the other parties. So the statutory requirements for what is in there, what is required, doesn't always apply. And the record shows that in a minimum of three of the recipients that are part of this case that made up over $100,000 of the overpayment determination were in fact PCA choice recipients because their files showed that they had signed PCA choice agreements. And that, in my opinion, is just completely ignored by the Department of Human Services and by saying that all recipients have to have the same PCA care plans that have these certain requirements, even though some of them apparently were PCA choice. So that's one issue. The other issue is in the statute that sets out the specifications for sanctions, there is a separate item in there that says a ground for sanctions is when a entity has been warned or fined about not maintaining adequate health records or financial records, then they do it again, then they can be sanctioned. It seems in the idea that you read a statute and as a whole, why would there be that requirement that a party had already been fined or warned about maintaining their health records if the Department of Human Services can say, well, anytime that you don't comply with the health service records in the statute, then that's grounds for sanctions because that seems to conflict with that other than it being something that is specific as to what is considered abuse. And
that's not the only reason why the sanction was imposed here. I mean, the records were not provided when they were requested multiple times. And that fact is undisputed as far as I can tell.
It is undisputed that the appellants did not provide all the records on the same day that they were requested at the first visit. I think virtually all of them were requested on the second visit, except for one. Many records were provided after the fact, some of which were considered by the department, and some that came in after kind of the agreed upon deadline were not considered. My argument would be that to the extent that the care plans do comply with what the rules require as far as not having been considered specifically abuse, or as far as what is required for a PCA choice care plan, that if they ultimately were provided, the fact that they weren't provided in the first day shouldn't be grounds for monetary recovery, as long as that they, you know, were complied when they eventually were provided.
Thank you, Mr. Kuhn. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Balmakhand.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Zuri Balmakhand, and I represent respondents in this matter, the Minnesota Department of Human Services. In this case, the commissioner applied Minnesota statute and rule as they were written. She conducted a thorough investigation with evidence before issuing an overpayment. And she used her discretion to reduce a sanction to a 1-year suspension for relators in this case. The issues perceived by relators in this case are unsupported by the law, as well as the record as it currently exists before this court. Respondents are requesting that the court affirm the commissioner's final order for 3 reasons. First, because the commissioner correctly determined that the medical health records that were maintained by relators in this case violated Minnesota statute and rule. Second, because substantial evidence exists within this limited record to support the commissioner's conclusion that an overpayment amount should have been issued in this case. And third, because the director was the controlling party for both entities and a suspension was thus appropriate for relators. First, the commissioner correctly found that the manner in which relators maintained their records, health maintenance records in this instance, were in violation of Minnesota Statute 256B.0659, as well as Minnesota Rule 9505.2160. Now, respondents do not believe that there is any ambiguity within the rules as written or the statute as written. But if this court were to give credence to relator's argument, the court should defer to the agency's interpretation of the statutes and rules that were applied here. Now, Minnesota rules are meant to be read in conjunction with Chapter 256B. In fact, it's Minnesota Rule 9505.2160 that states explicitly these rules are intended to be read in conjunction with Chapter 256B. Interpreting that either the rule or statute are meant to be read independently leads to an absurd result. And as I indicated within our briefing, Your Honors, that absurd result could be something like, 2 separate written doctrines dictating what elements need to be within a health record and causing confusion amongst vendors in terms of what elements are actually required for them to meet the requirements of the program. Now, both the ALJ and the commissioner reviewed this argument when it was made in the lower court in the Office of Administrative Hearings. And both the ALJ and the commissioner determined that this argument does not have merit, both concluding that, again, it would lead to an absurd result if you were to read them independently. In fact, the statute itself also makes reference to requiring the rule to be read in conjunction with the language within the statute. Now, even if this court accepted relator's argument, precedent dictates that when there is ambiguity between a rule and a statute, that the statute dictates. And here, the statute determines that relator's health records do not provide for the elements that are required within Minnesota statute here. And again, that's Minnesota statute 256B.2160. For those reasons, Your Honor, the department is requesting that the court find that the commissioner did appropriately read the rules and the statutes in conjunction to determine that the records maintained by relators in this case were maintained in violation of both rule and statute. Second, substantial evidence exists within the limited record to support the overpayment amount as issued by the commissioner, and that is the overpayment amount of $608,587.33. Now, this court gives substantial deference to the fact-finding process that is conducted by the administrative agency, and it upholds an agency's decision when it's supported by evidence within the record. That's evidence that supports the final conclusion. Now, first, relator's argument is waived because they failed to provide this court with the full record as noted by Judge Riley earlier and outlined within respondent's briefing. Without the transcript before the court, it is difficult for the court to reach a conclusion without having all of the information before it. And there's precedent that exists that states that when courts are found in this very in this very position that they cannot make a decision as to relator's request because they do not have the tools necessary for them to reach a conclusion. Second, if the court were to analyze the existing record, it would find that substantial evidence within this existing record supports the commissioner's ultimate conclusion of imposing the overpayment amount that I had stated earlier.
Same now, if the court kind of a more basic question, is there a difference in the rules and statutes between a sanction and an overpayment determination, or are they considered one and the same?
Your Honor, there is a difference between a sanction and an overpayment amount. An overpayment amount is not necessarily considered a sanction, whereas a suspension, a fine, or ultimate termination would be considered a sanction.
Thank you.
Now, there are pieces of evidence within the existing record that support the commissioner's overpayment issuance in this case. And those pieces of evidence include not only the ALJ's report or order, which outlines the records that the ALJ reviewed, as well as makes reference to the transcript, obviously the in-person hearing that the ALJ was able to consider, but as well as the commissioner's original report and the commissioner's final order. In addition to that, if this court were to review the department's exhibits as they had been presented within the trial, you would see that not all of the records that were requested by the department for the recipients requested were actually provided. The records that were provided outlined errors that were in violation of both the statute as well as the rule. And there were also duplicate files within this record, where the record care plan that was provided initially was purported to be the same record care plan that was provided at a subsequent date, but the information on both of these documents, even though it had the same recipient name, was different. And for those reasons, Your Honor, the respondents in this case are requesting that the court uphold the commissioner's issuance of the overpayment amount for the full amount as outlined by the ALJ and the commissioner. Finally, Your Honors, the commissioner correctly determined that a one-year suspension was appropriate for both One Best Care as well as One Network Care as relators in this case. Now, before I begin my argument, I do want to clarify a point that Mr. Kuhn made, that he had raised this issue at the lower court before the ALJ as well as the commissioner. And I think that perhaps we are conflating issues here. The issue is not that One Network Care was suspended, but the argument is that One Network Care should not be intertwined with One Best Care and then receive a suspension. It's that element of the two entities being intertwined that is being argued that was not argued before the lower court. And that is why relator's argument should be waived before this court this afternoon. Now, if this court were to review the argument made by relators, it's important to note that the department did in fact make a nature, severity, and chronicity finding on behalf of One Network Care independent to One Best Care. That was testified to within the record by the investigator, Melanie Labrie, who is a senior investigator on behalf of the department. That was referenced by the ALJ in his order, as he had outlined that when he refers to appellants within his order, he is referring to One Best Care and One Network Care. And that is also present in exhibit number 21 presented by the department at trial. That is a letter to One Network Care dated December 19th of 2018, notifying One Network Care that a nature, severity, and chronicity finding has determined that it should be terminated from the program.
Can you identify where in the ALJ's order there's reference to One Network Care? I mean, I saw it in paragraph 8, but that paragraph only indicates that One Network Care had been implicated in the department's sanctions arising from violations attributable to One Best Care, but the services to its recipients were not specifically investigated. So is there some other reference to One Network Care that I'm missing or I overlooked in the ALJ's order?
Certainly, Your Honor, allow me to clarify. What I was saying is that the ALJ's order had considered both programs in reaching its final conclusion, and that's outlined within the ALJ's initial paragraph when he states that, you know, Mr. Kuhn represented both parties in this case. Through the remainder of this order, I'm going to refer to One Network Care and One Best Care as appellants, and he considered all of the evidence presented on behalf of One Best Care in documentation form, and some of the evidence that was also in documentation form on behalf of One Network Care.
But the specific findings and conclusion, I mean, I don't disagree with you that Mr. Kuhn appeared on behalf of both of the appellants and that there were references to them as a collective, as appellants, both the entities, but it seems as though there are a lot of findings that the ALJ made that are specific to One Best Care and no findings that are specific to One Network Care. So I'm just wondering what the basis is for the suspension of One Network Care when none of the findings relate to One Network Care.
Understood, Your Honor. So this is a great example of why, for example, the transcript would have been helpful to the court in its assessment of whether or not substantial evidence exists to support these findings. For example, within the testimony, this court would have been able to see that the investigator did discuss the nature, severity, and chronicity assessment that the department had independently made on behalf of One Network Care. In addition to that, Your Honor, there are documents within the record, though they may not be noted in the ALJ's order. Unfortunately, I just don't have a reference to that offhand. They do exist within the record to show that there is documentation that One Network Care's practice in maintaining their health records was not organized in the same manner that it was not organized for One Best Care. The practice or failure to maintain health records correctly was presented by both departments. But going back to why the department made the decision to terminate and the commissioner then amended to a suspension, it was based on how both entities were controlled. And that goes to Mr. Iwu, who is the owner of both entities and the vendor in this case, how he submitted the billing on behalf of both entities, how he was the sole owner, director, and manager of both entities. He conducted all interviews, he made all employment decisions. And in addition to that, both entities had the same federal identification number for tax purposes. Now, I provided some case law within my brief to support this argument that One Best Care and One Network Care are so intertwined that it would have been reckless for the department to ignore the inadequacies and deficiencies it viewed within One Best Care and One Network Care's record-keeping practices. And that is Johns v. Harbridge, Your Honors, where the court held that two entities are assumed to be equally liable when the entity's operations are interrelated, they share common management, there's centralized control of labor relations, and the entities share common ownership or financial structure. Now, for those reasons that I had already outlined, Your Honor, respondents are requesting that the court affirm the commissioner's final order in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Kuhn, do you have any rebuttal?
Just on one issue, Your Honor, as to the transcript. So I will just bring the court's attention to in appellate's statement of the case, I indicated that a transcript was necessary. And then in respondent's statement of the case, it also indicated a transcript was necessary and stated that a transcript had been emailed on April 16th, 2020 to respondent by the court reporter. I don't know how to read that other than the transcript had already been created and had been obtained by respondent. So I didn't do anything further regarding the transcript. And then it subsequently, the court inquired, like, where is the transcript? And it didn't exist. So I don't think based on appellant's arguments that having the transcript is essential since they primarily are of statutory construction and legal conclusions. But to the extent that the court does feel that their decision is impacted by not having a transcript, that should not be blamed on appellants, and any benefit of the doubt should go towards us rather than responding on that. And I would yield the rest of my time.
Thank you very much. The case was well briefed and well argued, and we will have our decision out within the 90 days.
Thank you.